Good evening, everyone. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Lakshmi Sadhu.
I'm Max Newman.
I'm Milena Carrasco.
I'm Armand Rana.
I'm Hannah Toms.
And it's Thursday, June 6th at 5 o'clock p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
On today's show, we are going to be talking about the controversies surrounding the results of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women report, as well as an incident of racial profiling of a black student, and invited speaker from Acadia University at UBC's ongoing Humanities and Social Sciences conference. We also have a piece about the iftar gathering on UBC Farm, which Aman attended last Friday. If we're lucky, we'll also be able to sneak in Hannah's interesting piece from last week about colonial street names in Vancouver.
So commissioners for the National Inquiry into Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls say the report's conclusion that genocide was committed against Indigenous people in Canada is justified because of generations of violence. However, some critics argue that the term genocide is not truly applicable to this instance of tragedy and violence. Often when you think of the word genocide, you think of the Holocaust or what happened in Rwanda in the 90s. So essentially, mass killings of a group of people in a very specific manner or with specific intent. One of the people who has some hesitancy with the word genocide is actually Romeo Dallaire, who is a retired senator and general who led the United Nations peacekeeping force on that ill-fated mission in Rwanda in the 90s. And he saw the genocide unfold there. Before Dallaire got deployed to Rwanda, he very closely read the definition of genocide. And he says that he's not really sure it applies in this case. Here's what he had to say about the usage of the term genocide.
Was a deliberate act of a government to exterminate deliberately and by force and directly an ethnicity or a group or an entity of human beings. What has been done with the abandonment of the Aboriginal people and particularly the women in this country, is that a genocide? I got a real problem in trying to put the two together.
But of course,
that is a very interesting point.
Another point of controversy is the Gladue principle. It's a principle used in the Canadian legal system to give a lighter sentence to Indigenous peoples because of the intergenerational trauma they have experienced, and which has caused a tremendous amount of grief and toxic patterns of reaction that come with it. The principle began 20 years ago when a 19-year-old Indigenous woman stabbed her husband to death because of his infidelity while he was intoxicated. So the controversy with this case is that this principle doesn't protect Indigenous women who are being attacked by Indigenous men, or at least that's one perspective of it, and that in victimizing Indigenous peoples, they are not being protected as well as they could be. So I kind of just want to open it up to you guys. I mean, do you guys think that the Gladue principle is addressing the root of the problem? And how might this maybe connect with the recent report of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Report?
This semester, I'm a student at UBC, here at UBC, and this semester just gone, I took a course in criminology. It was a sociology of crime course, and we learned a lot about the liberal perspective of criminology, which is a perspective of criminology that believes that punishment is, the most predominantly used form of punishment in our criminal justice system here in Canada and most of the Western world is imprisonment. And the liberal principle states that imprisonment as a form of punishment does not address any of the root causes that cause crime. In fact, it usually breeds crime because, you know, imprisoning people means that they don't have access to, most of the time they don't have access to resources or services that can actually reform them as members of society and mean that when they leave prison and become reintegrated into society, they can be functional members of society and succeed. Mm-hmm. Imprisoning people usually means they don't have access to things like rehabilitation or, help like building their resumes and building employability skills or seeking, you know, the mental health treatment or the addiction treatment that they need in order to, like, succeed better as living within law than they had previously. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I support the GLADU principle because usually it means lighter sentences or alternatives to imprisonment, like, you know, halfway houses or not halfway houses. I forget the name, but
I think they are called
halfway
homes.
Houses. Yeah. Okay. And you know, community service, restorative justice. And mm-hmm. I'm against imprisonment in general as a form of punishment. I'm with the liberal principle. I mean, the conservative approach in criminology, you know, states that imprisonment should be used as a form of punishment in our criminal justice system because it isolates like the quote-unquote dangerous people of society from the rest of society and kind of is retributive. Like it means that people receive their just desserts. I'm against imprisonment. You know, I'm more with the liberal, much more with the liberal approach to criminology. I agree with that perspective that imprisonment, you know, if anything, it is worse for society and for the people it is aimed to punish. So yeah, I'm with the GLADU principle. I don't think imprisonment should be used as a criminal justice strategy. Like only extremely for like the most extreme cases of someone actually being dangerous to society. But yeah, I'm in general for like restorative justice or community service or, you know, rehabilitation, mental health services for criminals.
And, yeah. And those are all good points, but do you think there's some kind of I feel like there's a point of contention there with it kind of mitigating overrepresentation of indigenous people in prison systems, but then also somehow letting indigenous perpetrators get away with lighter sentences when it's an indigenous woman in question. And that's one of the things that has been coming out mm-hmm. of the missing and murdered indigenous women report.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I really have the authority to comment on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just kind of stated like what I learned in my criminology class. I didn't learn about this particular mm-hmm. side of it. Like, is that further victimizing indigenous women rather than, you know, trying to give them an alternative to imprisonment? Because indigenous people and indigenous women in particular are vastly overrepresented in our prison system. Mm-hmm. Again, like I'm not indigenous, I'm white. I feel like I don't have the knowledge or like the experience to really comment on this issue. But
yeah, those are really good points. One thing to keep in mind is that it's not necessary that the GLADU principle results in lighter sentences for indigenous perpetrators. It's just something that the report stated that there should be looked into, mm-hmm. because the reality is indigenous people are overrepresented, even though the GLADU principle exists today.
And it's been existing for the past 20 years.
Yeah. So, and also what the GLADU principle actually just requires is that a report is made that takes into account the social context of the perpetrator when doing sentencing. And I think it's often the case even for non-Indigenous people that their social context is also taken into account. Mm-hmm. And I think that just the report, because maybe the judge who's sentencing them may not have that awareness, it kind of forces them, in the case of Indigenous people, to go the extra step of officiating it into a report. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it does not necessitate that they'll get lighter sentences. And I think that's one thing mm-hmm. to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. And switching gears a little bit, what we talked about earlier, the word genocide is arguably one of the things that's really blowing up about the whole report in general. I'm just curious about what your opinion is. Do you think the word genocide is warranted in this case, or is it just systemic racism?
I mean, I agree with what people who are for labeling this issue as genocide are, you know, the reasons why they're behind it, because it'll give that, using that term, we hope will give that sense of urgency to, like, local, provincial, and the federal government to, like, treat it as an emergency, which it is. And, you know, like, Indigenous women have been, like, going missing and murdered at such a higher rate than non-Indigenous people and non-Indigenous women. It's, you know, it's been happening for so long, and it's time that it's treated more urgently and is more of an emergency than it is. So I agree with that side of calling it genocide. Mm-hmm. But then, I don't know, I guess maybe it doesn't meet the technical definition of genocide, mm-hmm. like that man was saying in that video. Mm-hmm. But I agree with the reasons why they want to call it a genocide. I think that word does have the urgency behind it, the urgency with which this issue should be treated and should have started to be treated a really long time ago.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think that if we need to label it as genocide for people to listen, I mean, then so be it. Or, I don't know, then that's what it should be. I mean, now we're seeing reports from, what was it, Amnesty International, and it's finally gone on the global scale because of this word. So whether this word ends up being, I don't know, codified in our law books and in our history books in Canada, I think that, you know, we just have to recognize this with the severity that it is. And, yeah, I don't know what else to...
And Pete Fry had some very interesting things to say about how we can bring... So the report had a lot of solutions on a federal level, and Pete Fry had some interesting things to say about how we can bring it down to a more provincial level in terms of safeguarding the rights of Indigenous women and girls. And we'll take a listen to what he had to say right after a short break for some PSAs and ads. Listeners, there'll be more from Democracy Watch right after this short break. Stay tuned to CITR Radio at 101.9 FM. We'll be right back.
To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys a
If you really want to know more about fashion, come on down to CITR in the Student Union Building of UBC and pick up some of our merchandise à la mode. Nous avons t-shirts, sweatshirts, socks, and coffee mugs.
But it's also very aesthetically gripping.
To keep you styling in support of the station you love. Isn't that right, Jonathan?
Well, actually, is it? Because, I mean, you know, I was going to say because of the cultural vacuum that we exist within, but then, you know, really, fashion today is kind of derived from the European idea of couture, and that's been around for centuries.
Am I wrong?
Man, they were nihilists, man.
Huh?
They kept saying they believed in nothing.
Niles.
The Greatest Date from Nihilism, Rediscovering Our Passion in Late Modernity by Dr. Gordon E. Karkner involves a journey out of the prison of contemporary nihilism and into a meaningful life trajectory. Rooted in the work of Canadian premier philosopher Charles Taylor, this book is a relevant read for students and faculty. You can find it at the UBC or Regent bookstores.
Who's the f***ing nihilist around here, you bunch of f***ing crybabies?
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theatre, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theatre, visit their website at www.riotheatre.ca.
Discorder Magazine has been supporting local music for over 30 years. Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Your favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder Magazine or at rickshawtheater.com. To understand more about fashion, we asked CITR student executive and fashion expert Jonathan Q what fashion means to him.
Like, it's just aesthetically something that's so ostentatious. Typically. I mean, because of course, I mean, it's also, you know, I mean, when you say fashion, I think people are talking explicitly about consumerism as opposed to someone who buys, like, you know, let's say, you know, someone buys
And And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR Radio at 101.9 FM. And before the break, we were talking about the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Report, the controversy surrounding the Gladue Principle and the term genocide, and how problematic that is. So a lot of the solutions from the report are on a federal level, and Pete Fry has quite a couple of solutions to offer on a more provincial level. Here is what he had to say. And a little credit, this is from CBC's Early Edition with Stephen Quinn. All right, we're facing some technical difficulties. We'll try to play that clip later on in today's show. Armand, you attended an iftar gathering at the UBC Farm last week. So for those listeners who aren't familiar with what that is, can you tell us a little bit about the meaning and significance of iftar?
Yeah, so in the Islamic faith during the month of Ramadan, iftar, when Muslims fast, iftar is the evening meal that takes place after sunset that breaks the daily fast. And yeah, in this particular case, it was a community iftar, so members of the community could come out to UBC Farm and attend the iftar and bring their own food. And yeah,
very cool. So let's take a listen to some interviews that you recorded at the farm.
Mark on a farm tour. Let's gather in a circle. If you're waiting for friends or would like to otherwise hang out in the greenhouse and opt out of the farm tour, please feel free to do so, and we will regroup there. Yeah. Do you want to start the circle? It seems like we have more people than I realized.
Yeah.
Cool. My name is Chi, and I grew up in Vancouver, and I was in the Land and Food Systems faculty. It is now called Land and Food Systems, not agriculture. To more holistically think about land and food systems. I inherited these stories from being the site manager in this space and talking to a lot of people that would pass by that would still come to our farmers market today. And so that's a really key part for us to depart from this space from.
So how do you see the connection between this event about Ramadan and nature and the farm?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any connections between the two?
Well, I think the thing that comes up to my mind is the spiritual part, like this is a month of giving and like doing more acts of kindness and charity, and at the same time being out in nature, seeing how actually the nature is kind of like giving us back, and having this moment to get disconnected from everything that's in the big city kind of like makes you calmer and kind of like contemplate and appreciate more of what you have in life. So I think like these two go hand in hand together.
Awesome. So how do you see the connections between iftar and being on a farm with nature, if any?
We're all doing chicken.
Well, I would say that it would be... that's a good question. There is inherently a material aspect to fasting and to Ramadan, and iftar is when we break our fast, when we finally are able to say, as we have removed ourselves from sustaining ourselves materially, how do we then reconnect to material sustenance again? And that's I think one of the connections that one can make with being on a farm, reconnecting to once again taking in material sustenance, once again understanding where this material sustenance comes from, and then ultimately being grateful for it. That would be my answer.
Hi.
Hi.
How did you like the... Can you tell us a bit about what's your name and how do you like the farm tour?
Well, my name is Deemba, and what I liked about the farm tour is I get to like learn a lot of different stuff. And something that I liked is that how... Like, I didn't know that there's no difference between like the caged and like free-run and free-range eggs. I thought like it actually made a difference, but like it doesn't.
Do you know which type of eggs you used to get at home?
Well, what eggs did we used to get at home?
Free run.
Free run.
So are you not going to get those anymore?
Probably.
And how old are you?
11.
And have you been to the UBC farm before?
Yeah, I've been to it in a spring break camp and I think maybe a field trip.
Oh yeah? And you like it here?
Yeah.
What do you like about the farm?
Well, it just feels earthy. I don't know how to explain it.
And
really nice.
And do you, like, today is, well, this month is Ramadan, right?
Yeah.
And do you think it's a good idea to you know, have an iftar at a farm?
Yeah, it's like a nice idea. I don't know how to explain it.
Why do you think it's a good idea?
I don't know how. It just feels like it's a good idea.
Okay.
That sounds really weird.
Tell me a bit about yourself and how did you and your friend end up here? Find out about this event.
Well, I found out about this event through my friend. And I visited UBC Farm before, so I was excited to go back. Yeah, I was kind of going into it without kind of knowing too much about the tour and what was going on, but I feel like I'm learning a lot, so I'm enjoying it.
And do you see any connections between, you know, the celebration of Ramadan or the celebration of iftar and it taking place on a farm?
I guess, I don't know if maybe Jifa, you want to speak a little bit more to that.
Well, I think it's just, it's a time for reflection, and I think it's really nice to be connected to the land and think about where the food we eat comes from and just be grateful for that and think about all the steps in that process and, yeah.
Yeah, being more conscious about where food comes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I heard about the event from a friend, and I was really interested because I have a passion for food, nutrition, and sustainable farming, and I'd never been here, but I had a hunch that it would be a beautiful place, and it's just an amazing place. So a good mix, a beautiful mix, I think, of academia coming together with people who just are interested in, you know, growing food and having sustainable systems and caring for our environment. So we've just had a tour, and it's an amazing place. It's an amazing place with all sorts of things growing, the bees, the chickens, and I think really, really intelligent, thoughtful people putting together a system that works together. So we're enjoying our evening.
And do you see any connection between the iftar and it being on a farm? Do you see any significance to that?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's bringing a lot of meaning to it, because one of the things that we as Muslims are encouraged to consider is, you know, where our food comes from, the blessings that we have in, you know, having food available to us, and of course acknowledging and being grateful for where it comes from. So coming to a farm and seeing where the food originates is really meaningful, more meaningful than going and grabbing it from the grocery store.
And you spoke earlier about sustainability. Do you see that also connected in some way to Islam in general and to Ramadan in particular?
Yes, I think we all have. Muslims are keenly aware of that, but we all, as people living on this earth, have an obligation to be responsible, live responsibly in our world, and maintain it, and live in a way that's, I guess, sustainable is the word that we use now, but just in a way that's not overbearing and taking too much. So Islam does encourage that, is that we're here as caregivers for the place that we're living in. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. Very cool. I think we can all agree
that the 11-year-old was hands down the best interviewee. So, Armand, what made you interested in this particular iftar at the UBC Forum?
Yeah, I'll get into that in a second. First of all, with the 11-year-old, one thing she said is that she actually is coming to UBC to do radio training on a summer camp.
So interesting.
The circle completes, right?
Wow.
I got interested in this because it was a community iftar. I'd been to one last year, and it was a really interesting event. I knew that preservation of nature plays an important role in the Islamic faith, and I just wanted to see, you know, how that is unpacked at this event, and it was really interesting.
Did you go with friends?
Yeah, I went with my family, actually.
Cool. And yeah. And you're Hindu, though?
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, it's always good to learn about other religions.
How was the food?
It was really good.
Can I ask what they had?
It was like, because this time it was more potluck, so there was like a really diversity of food. Like there was some Indian food, there was some Middle Eastern food, there was some like very Vancouver food. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of like, there's like a huge salad, spinach salad. Because there's a lot of spinach that the farm had, like that extra spinach. So
a lot of vegetarian options.
Gotta get your greens in.
Yeah, gotta get your iron in.
Oh, yeah. Well, moving on from greens. This last Sunday, June 2nd, right here on campus at the UBC Conference for Humanities and Social Sciences, for anybody listening out in the nest there, they're right. I think the conference is on the first and second floor. Shelby McPhee, a Black student from the Black Canadian Students Association, was actually racially profiled and accused of stealing a laptop at the conference. So, for a little backstory, Shelby McPhee is a very accomplished political science student from Nova Scotia who goes to Acadia University. It was his second time being invited to the conference, but his first time actually attending. And while reading his experience in an open letter that he wrote, left a really bitter taste in my mouth and honestly in the pit of my stomach. So I reached out to him for an interview, but unfortunately he was not able to meet this week. But if we're lucky, tune in next week to hear a one-on-one with Shelby to hear more on his story. But here in an open letter to the Federation of Humanities and Social Sciences, he describes how, allegedly, he was walking around the conference with his other white male colleague when he noticed that two other white male attendees had begun to follow them and then started to take pictures. So after this, Shelby just kind of went over to the volunteer booth and asked the men what was going on. And one of them told him that he recognized his colleague, the white male, from earlier in that day, but not Shelby. And he also notes that this was despite the fact that Shelby had an ID lanyard and was holding all of his documents for his presentation, while his friend was not. It was then when the man accused Shelby of stealing his laptop and proceeded to call the RCMP. Shelby then voluntarily waited for the RCMP, was publicly detained, interrogated, and had his bag searched by the RCMP. He produced not two, but three pieces of valid ID and was finally let go by the RCMP because they had insufficient evidence and proof that he had stolen anything. In the open letter, Shelby also asks the Conference for Humanities and Social Sciences two very specific things, two calls for action. Number one, the immediate expulsion of the two attendees who had racially profiled and called the police on him falsely. And number two, a statement from the Federation which clarifies their position on the situation and one which affirms their commitment to creating a safe and diverse environment for all. It's also important to mention that all three things that those two attendees allegedly did, stalk, harass, and take pictures of others without their consent, goes directly against the UBC Code of Conduct, which ensures, quote, a safe, respectable, and collegial experience, end quote. This is completely disheartening to hear. As a proud UBC student majoring in political science, I don't know, this when I heard of this or saw this, I think the first media post I saw on it was from Van City Buzz. And I saw it on my feed and I was completely disheartened. I'm really hoping that I think I was in contact with Shelby McPhee on Facebook, and I think we'll be able to schedule an interview earlier next week. So Yeah, I don't know. I'm just going to open it up there. Thoughts, feelings?
That's really messed up that they just, like, see a black guy and they're like, okay, that guy stole my laptop. That's, like, super messed up. I don't know how you could do that. I don't have much more to say about it.
I mean, I don't know if this is an unpopular opinion, but I'm not really that surprised that it took place at UBC on a university campus or at a social sciences and humanities conference. To me, that's not that shocking. I think there's a lot of subtle racism or kind of, there's a lot of, the academic experience is rooted in systems of oppression and colonialism. So it's not shocking to me that something like this would happen.
Online, I actually found the code of conduct. Yeah, Shelby quoted some of it in his open letter to UBC, but this is the full Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences Congress code of conduct, and it states in the conduct that it is the policy of the Federation that all participants in Congress activities are entitled to enjoy an environment free from all forms of discrimination, harassment, and retaliation. Yeah, it says later that the Federation is dedicated to providing a harassment-free Congress experience for everyone, regardless of gender, gender identity and expression, age, sexual orientation, disability, physical appearance, body size, race, ethnicity, or religion. We do not tolerate harassment of Congress participants in any form. Yeah, so, I mean, clearly those two attendees who racially profiled Shelby weren't guilty of doing all of the above. And, you know, explicitly going against what the Congress is meant to stand for. I think those two attendees should be really ashamed of themselves. That's just really disgraceful behavior. Yeah, not excusable.
And I'm surprised at how fast the RCMP reacted to that. I mean, it doesn't seem like there was a lot of kind of buffer time between the two attendees calling the police and then the RCMP taking action right away against Shelby.
That's what makes it disturbing to me, because I think one thing people have to keep in mind when you call the police on someone of color is that the police oftentimes has their own institutional discrimination that they're going to bring and act with a huge amount of severity to even the accusation of a very petty crime. So that's what makes it particularly
disturbing
behavior.
And I mean, you also have to think about the fact that he was publicly detained. All of this was public in front of, I'm guessing, a lot of people, in front of a lot of volunteers who were attending the conference. I mean, I think that not only should we think about those two attendees, although for sure they should be ashamed of themselves, but also the volunteers who witnessed that and who didn't, at least from all the things that I've read and Shelby has said, no one stood up for him. No one was there. And I think that, silence is just as bad, if not worse, than saying something negative about this or being racist.
Yeah. And this is where the conversation about being an ally comes in, because you can have all the theoretical or even verbal discourse about, you know, how to decolonize daily spaces and how
academia, right?
Anti-racism, anti all kinds of bigotry and prejudice. But when push comes to shove, then people get very uncomfortable. When things become too real, when there's actually a very questionable incident happening in front of you, all of a sudden people just step back. And I've seen this happen in, like, even in my own department, being a recent graduate of journalism, you know, we always have conversations about marginalized communities, how to decolonize daily spaces, racism, all that stuff. But when you're actually put in a situation where you have to choose a side, people choose their own.
Difficult conversations like that are so easy to theorize about and to write articles and reports about, which probably a lot of people at that conference were invited there to present. But like you said, when people are actually in those situations, who's actually going to ignite those words that they write? Or who's, going to actually quote in person all those people they cite?
Yeah, or stand behind, you know, the Constitution that Hannah just read out about that the conference stands for, I guess. And, I mean, if you, like, kind of change the roles a little bit, like, what if it was a white woman who was being accused of this? What if it was two black men following her and taking pictures of this? Like, how would that have played out?
And how would the police have reacted differently?
Yeah, exactly. gender, race.
How would maybe the volunteers would have said something? Yeah. I don't know.
What if it was a hijabi woman? I don't know. Keeping on the theme with iftar. Yeah, complicated conversations. Does anyone else have anything else to add about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really sickening to think about what must have been going through those two white attendees' heads. Like, because, I mean, the RCMP found that there is absolutely no evidence to suggest that it had been Shelby who had taken the laptop. So it's like, on what basis they just picked him out of the crowd and was like, oh, it was probably that black person. Mm-hmm. Like, based on what? Based on absolutely nothing except racism. So it's really angering that you know, people like that came to attend a conference at my university. It's really upsetting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, how about we take a little break? Stay tuned to Democracy Watch. This is CITR Radio at 101.9 FM.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend, and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
The annual Sled Island Music and Arts Festival returns to Calgary from June 19th to 23rd, 2019. Discover over 250 bands, comedy, film, and art in more than 30 venues across the city. This year's festival features guest curator Julian Baker, acclaimed indie pop artist Japanese Breakfast, the incomparable hip-hop stylings of Rap City, experimental noise rapper JPEG Mafia, subversive hip-hop artist Leaf, raspy indie folk favorites Hop Along, anthemic grunge rockers Bully, and over 180 more artists still to be announced. To see the current lineup and to get your festival pass, visit sledisland.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR Radio at 101.9 FM. Sorry, Max, Armand, and Milena are hilarious during these little ad breaks. It's really hard
to keep
myself together. So for those listeners who didn't catch last week's episode, Hannah had put together a piece about the legacy of colonialism in Vancouver's street names. And we didn't really get to discuss it too much since we ran out of time last time. So Hannah, we're going to jump into your piece once again. Why don't you set the stage for our listeners?
Oh, sure. So my inspiration for this piece was an article by Emma Rennerts called "Oh No, My Street's Named After a Racist" that was published in the TIE on May 23rd. It centers on an Indigenous woman by the name of Jessie Lawyer, who discovered recently that Trutch Street, the street that she lives on, is named after Joseph Trutch, a very racist political figure in British Columbia's history. Outrageously, Trutch is not unique in having his legacy honored in our city to this day through his name representing a public space. Many other racist old white guys who held political positions during the 19th century are the namesakes of streets, parks, and buildings in Vancouver, like Wilfrid Laurier, John A. MacDonald, Frederick Seymour. The list goes on. So for this piece, I chose to focus in particular on John Robson, for whom Robson Street is named. In the early 1870s, while a member of BC's Legislative Assembly, Robson proposed an amendment to BC's voting laws to disenfranchise Indigenous and Chinese people, which was passed in 1874. Around that time, he was among the first politicians to support the Chinese head tax, a discriminatory policy charging an expensive fee for Chinese people wanting to move to Canada, which became law in 1885 under the Chinese Immigration Act. After he became Premier of BC in 1889, Robson expanded the reserve system across the province in order to force Indigenous people from their land, which he then made available to white European settlers instead. So last week, I stood at the corner of Robson and Homer Street and shared this information about John Robson with passersby. I then asked these individuals to share their thoughts on learning who this iconic Vancouver street is named after.
I'm hoping they'll change the names. That's what I'm hoping for.
I have no problem with them changing the name. At the same time, do I feel like there's better uses of civil servants' times? Yes.
I think we need to be as inclusive as possible. We need to look at the balance. Okay, it's pretty obvious that there's so many more things are named after men. So many more historical stories are recorded about men and the things that they do. This is one of the things that we can change. And also, yeah, the Indigenous people who populated this land and made such incredible contributions to what we now enjoy in Vancouver need to be recognized as well.
I think there should be a lot more like historical Indigenous names on the signs around here. And probably, yeah, I mean, the Chinese community was a huge part in building this city, so obviously they should get some credit for it too.
Personally, I don't really care for them to be dedicating it towards First Nations or Indigenous communities. It has nothing to do with being pro or anti-Indigenous culture. I understand why it is that we remember and learn and educate ourselves on atrocities or issues that were committed in the past. I mean, personally, my family moved here in like 1912. We were Irish, we were persecuted. That's why we ended up leaving Ireland.
But you're living on stolen land, by like stolen from Indigenous people, right?
Sure, but I mean, all land's stolen. The Roman Empire stole a shit ton of land too. And presumably every empire before that was also stealing land. I'm not saying that it's the right thing to do, but it seems like most culture that has existed from the dawn of humankind, shall we say, it's all born out of egregious acts.
I've been doing research trying to educate myself about truth and reconciliation and what I can do as a settler ancestor, but I am trying to forward the more people are educated about this, because it totally changes your views about our city and what our responsibilities are. I'm asking myself all the time, like, what is my responsibility now? I'm 65 years old. I'm interested in reconciliation, but we need to work really hard on understanding the truth of our history, our Canadian history.
I don't necessarily think that naming streets or squares or public spaces in the name of Indigenous individuals is really counteracting that. I think that that's kind of just like apology politics. I think that it would be better to name it after someone who has had an influence on the contemporary society.
So you don't think that Indigenous people have an influence on contemporary society, is what you're saying?
No,
I don't want to put words in your mouth.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's a good question. I think that they do, but I think if you were to look at like individuals who've had massive impacts in BC or Vancouver, like, I think, I don't know if David Suzuki's from Vancouver, I think that would make sense to honor someone like him, or artists, public servants. Yeah, see, that's, I don't even know who you would name it after. I just don't know who's had a positive impact on Vancouver lately.
We need to not alienate the people who are going to be really reactionary to these ideas, because as a human being, I know that old habits are hard to change, and people get really upset when they don't really understand necessarily why we're doing this, and if it happens really quickly, it could lead to some reactionary voting, which I'm really scared of too.
I do see that there is good value in honoring individuals who've aided Vancouver in contemporary times. And I think that just as they did in the 1800s, honoring someone from what would be then contemporary times, it makes sense to do that now.
What about a contemporary Indigenous figure?
Yeah, if it's easily pronounceable then and like readable, then I'm all for it.
Pronounceable and readable for you as a white guy?
or white girl or Asian individual. I mean,
about an indigenous person?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would have to say that because they are in the minority and the majority of them speak an English tongue and not necessarily a native for the bulk of their communication, it would make more sense to do so with an English name.
There's so many things to talk about, and I think we have to understand human nature to know how to make changes so that we don't end up with reactionary swings, and we could change to a very fear-based situation if we just don't understand why these things are so egregious and why it's so hurtful and why it's so important just to know the truth. And then perhaps we need to have two names on Robson Street and give it its transition time and maybe rename it, but also have chance to get accustomed to that idea, because I think there's a lot of people in Canada who are still, whether they admit it or not, very racist and very unwilling to do any homework.
I'm French, and in France there was a discussion about l'avenue de la Grande Armée, which literally translates to avenue of the Great Army, the Grand Army, the Big Army. And what that makes reference to is the time that France had an army so big it went around pillaging and destroying half of Europe. And, you know, to call it the Great Army, what have you, it's not named after a man, it's reminiscent of an era. But what's important about it is that it's historical. It's a reminder. So when they did talk about getting rid of it or renaming it or calling it maybe something less glorifying than the Great Army, the Grand Army, they put out the fact that these things we commemorate in order to remember, even if it sometimes is for the purpose of being sad or being towards an end that is not always great, that's not always, morose. We have to remember that we are all here as a result of our past, and going forward, let's try not to repeat it.
I mean, I think a lot of the debate around that is, like, I think everyone agrees that atrocities, you know, should be remembered in order that we hope that history doesn't repeat itself.
Yeah.
But then it's like, for example, does that street sign belong out in the open? Like, because usually, I don't know, things like statues or street names or parks, it's seen as kind of a celebration of that event or that person and their legacy. So would that, does that street sign, like, belong in the center of a square, or does it belong in a museum?
I think that's up for the public to decide. I mean, if we were to just circle back around to naming streets or squares after individuals within the indigenous community, presumably indigenous communities were also at war and also committed egregious acts. I mean, scalping was invented by indigenous individuals, or
slavery preceded us by several thousand years.
Exactly. I mean, so I'm not denying the fact that white people have done shitty stuff in the past, but we aren't the only individuals who have done shitty stuff in the past. I think that the smarter play is to focus on what people are doing now that is of good value to society and honoring those individuals.
The only way we can progress in society is if we continue to learn from our mistakes. And I mean, I don't think erasing them is necessarily right, but I certainly don't think we should, like, reward people by having their names on things.
And ultimately, if you need 75% and 75% are okay with it, then you've got your popular demand. You've got your democracy that works right there.
That is interesting. So, Hannah, I'm curious about your experiences. Your experience, kind of, you know, doing the streeter. What did you think of the responses?
I was really blown away by what one of the speakers that you just heard was saying. The lady who said she was 65, like a white settler ancestor, trying to inform herself on, you know, what she can do as a white settler ancestor to embrace truth and reconciliation. She shared something very interesting, very tragic with me. She said that her ancestors were from England and Ireland, I believe she said, and had come over in the early 1900s, I think, like 1912 or, you know, sometime in the 1910s. And she told me that they settled in what is now Kitsilano, and that there was an indigenous village there already existing, and that the municipality, like the municipal government, had decided that as soon as the European settlement that was emerging in Kitsilano got to a population of 1,000 settlers, what they did at that point was they basically rounded up all of the indigenous people from the existing village that was on that land at the time. They forced these indigenous people onto a boat in the inlet, and once they were on that boat, they just burned their village down. to clear space for white people because they wanted, you know, they preferred for white people to be living in that space rather than indigenous people. So her grandparents were actually members of that 1,000 population that prompted the government to burn that indigenous village down. And I was actually biking along the seawall in Stanley Park today and through English Bay and looking out at, you know, there's the Bard on the Beach tents and there's a planetarium in Vanier Park, and just thinking of that story and thinking about, you know, these spaces, these beautiful spaces that we enjoy so much today in Vancouver, but how they got there. Like, that was the former site of that indigenous village that was burned down. And I've lived in Vancouver my whole life and I'd never heard that story. You know, everyone that I share that story with is very shocked. I think, you know, there needs to be more of an awareness among settler ancestors in Vancouver about what was here before us and what was done to the existing indigenous population and their spaces and their villages and their homes in order for us to enjoy these spaces that we occupy, that we were not welcome on and that we stole. So I think that story was my biggest takeaway.
That's really interesting. A common theme that I seem to pick up from these interviews is there is this kind of subtle like resistance or almost like a defensiveness to changing the names to, I don't know, indigenous names. Why do you think that is? Why are people so averse to kind of going back and pronouncing something that might be just a little bit harder to say?
That same lady I was talking about, she brought up a really important point, I think. I'm all for changing the names. I think in a perfect, ideal world, everyone would be too. But she brought up the point that, like she said, people won't admit it, but there are a lot of racist people in Canada and in Vancouver.
UBC.
And UBC, yeah, absolutely. You know, as we heard in the last segment, and who would take offense to the name being changed from what it currently is, Robson Street, after just such a horrible racist figure. Would take offense and wouldn't welcome the change. And as much as I wish that those people who would be opposed to it could just be irrelevant, like, we live in a democracy and those people, you know, have control over what happens to our city. And the point that the lady brought up was that changing...
Can I just interrupt you real fast?
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's true, but also funny that you said we live in a democracy and those people have most of the control over what happens
in
the city.
Well, I don't know, maybe not most of the control, but, you know, like they have the right to vote and mm-hmm. you know, what that lady was saying was that could cause reactionary voting. Like, if something really progressive on a pretty significant scale was done in Vancouver, like changing the names to honor Indigenous people rather than like people from 100 plus years ago who were just really awful and have such a legacy of racism and colonialism and hurt, you know, there might be a reactionary swing to the right in voting if people are like, I don't like this progressiveness. You know, I liked this street being named after someone racist, and, you know, I'm going to vote conservative for that reason. That is something I'm scared of. You know,
change. It's like people hear that word and like it sends shivers down their spine.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I find it. I don't know. It kind of reminded me of the whole like inconvenience with names. Yeah, I think this is something that a lot of people can relate to with like maybe difficult to pronounce immigrant names. My name is Milena, and I'm sure like you can insert that with anyone else's name who's like kind of like not white or like difficult to pronounce or like not anglicized. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, there's been like plenty of times where I've been sitting in the classroom from pre-K to grade 12 and maybe sometimes here when the prof calls your name where it's like, oh, that's really hard to say. You know what? I'm just going to call you Bob. I've literally heard that before. No, I swear, no, where it's like, I find it more with like, China, no, I swear, no, like China, not with Milena, but like with other names, with like Chinese names. I've literally heard people be like, you know what, I can't say, and I'm not even going to try to say it, but like, because I can't think mm-hmm. of a name, but I'm not going to say that. I'm going to change it into John or change it into, I don't know, something that my mouth can like pronounce easily. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, that's really cool that you're, you know, prioritizing what rolls off the tip of your tongue really nicely. Mm-hmm.
But do I exist for your convenience?
Mm. Yeah. Yes. I mean, I don't know, I just find it so funny. It's like, oh, well, that's really hard to pronounce. You know, a lot of your names are kind of like not, they're kind of hard
to pronounce. They're too easy to pronounce.
They're too easy, and they don't sound very nice, but I say them anyways. So if you could just try to, you know, just say my name properly, mm-hmm. and even just like, if you can't, but mm-hmm. like you try, mm-hmm. like that's cool.
I mean, I think people who don't have kind of Anglo-Saxon names always have alter egos at Starbucks. I know I do. I've been Amy at Starbucks for the past 10 years of my life.
I don't know if you guys know this, but I'm actually a barista. And, like, oh. I feel so bad whenever that happens. I'm like, no, please. I really want to try to get your name properly because I know. Trust me, I know. Yeah. But, like, yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah. And people have misspelled Amy before, too. Oh, God. Like, A-M-I-E. I don't know. It's like three syllables. How do you get that wrong?
I don't
understand.
Can't speak on behalf of.
And it's not just, I mean, it's not just names, like street names or actual names. I mean, you also have schools, you have statues that are, you know, named after some pretty, or built after some pretty problematic people.
So, yeah, like, you know, in Vancouver, we have the school called Churchill, and I think most people don't think about it. And I think most people in Vancouver think Churchill is a war hero from World War II.
And there's so many quotes on Instagram with, like, his motivational quotes.
Yeah, yeah. But, it, you know, that may be true from their perspective, but from, you know, my perspective and Lakshmi's perspective.
As Indians.
We grew up, and Churchill was the guy who was heavily involved in the Bengal famine. Lakshmi can give you some quotes about what he said at the time, about what he thought about the situation. And he actively caused it because he prevented you know the resources coming in there, and he took the food away from mm-hmm. the people.
And how many people died, Armand?
Like approximately in the millions.
Mm-hmm.
And even after that, he continued to do everything he could to prevent India from getting their democracy. So, from our perspective, he was a very reprehensible man. But and I think people should have that history when they choose to. To give places these kind of names.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, the only quote I do remember, and this is a direct quote, is he said, "Why hasn't Gandhi died yet?" Which is a very nice thing to say. All the more reason why the school that's named after him should probably reconsider what they're called.
Or, like, I don't know, something that just came up to my mind is, like, if you're going to make a statue and commemorate someone, and you're going to put, you know, that little plaque at the bottom that has a little biography... then, you know, put all of it.
Yeah, if be you completely did, transparent.
You know, because, I mean, I know that there are, like, people talking about recently with this same topic. Well, this person did a bunch of really great things, did a lot of not so great things. Okay, let's put it all down there mm-hmm. if you're going to, like, make a statue and let mm-hmm. people see that statue and make up their minds how they feel about it.
Exactly. Cherry picking is not the way to go. And having said that, we are... out of time for today. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. Thank you for listening to Democracy Watch on CITR Radio. Also, remember to subscribe to our podcast, Seeking Office. Up next on CITR is the Spencer Latu Show. Take care, and thanks for listening.